each one clasped by a human-like hand. I spun through the serpentine mass, hacking my way to the heart of it.
"You fool," he spat.
There was both hatred and terrible fear in that phlegmy voice.
"All you have done is strengthen the Lacrimosa. You understand? You do her will."
I always listened to the ravings of such creatures before I killed them. The words were invariably lies, but some kernel of useful truth often lay buried within somewhere, albeit meant to tantalize or mislead. The Lacrimosa was one of the Splintered's many named leaders. Her name had come up more than once as part of our researches. Here it was again. I did not, however, respond. I cared not if our actions here temporarily strengthened one of the insurrectionists' perpetually warring factions. They would all be cast down in time, one at a time, whatever their relative strengths. I severed one of his writhing wrist stumps with my blade, throwing a spray of black blood out, then closed on the creature's neck. He screamed at me. I felt a sudden surge of psionic force and was blasted backwards, my feet leaving the ground. I landed heavily, sliding across the stone to correct my stance. He screamed again, tentacles flying wildly, and a judder wave of stone-hard warp energy boiled out of the foment. Remaining upright in the face of that stream was a challenge. The cultists closest to us were thrown from their feet and sent cartwheeling into the air. By then, though, Garrodon was advancing in from the left flank, breaking out through a cluster of reeling fighters. His bolt pistol kicked, sending shells straight into the heart of the convolute's overspilling stomachs. That slowed the mutant down, puncturing its aura of psychic control, and I battled back in close. The noise in the chamber was by then truly deafening, a crescendo of bolt impacts and shrieking that just ramped up and up. I had the impression of many more than 20 guns firing, an error I attributed to psychic overspills throwing the vibrations around, though the effect was disorientating. By then, the convolute was properly unravelling. Garrodon's strikes had wounded it badly, and more perfectly aimed bolts were driving home all the time. I pivoted, slicing Gnosis in low and fast. Its edge cut deep this time, lacerating his chest and making him gasp bloodily. He reeled backwards, flailing all the while, and the pressure waves around him spun out of control. The floor cracked open, causing jets of pressurized steam to shoot up around us. The screams echoed. The flamelight whirled. Even amid this disintegration, he stared at me with an impressive level of hatred, blood bubbling at the corners of his slit-like mouth.
"You only make her stronger," he hissed. "Understand? Stronger!"
I rotated my blade, ready to plunge it home and end the creature's heresy. I never made the strike. Before I could do so, he was torn into pieces, blown into scraps, blasted into clumps of severed muscle that sailed through the flickering air. Bolt shells flew through the wreckage of his body, igniting as they impacted on his remnants, turning him into a thundering wall of fat-sizzling flame. For a moment, I was genuinely at a loss. Garrodon and his warriors had been pushing up along both flanks of the chamber and had been firing from positions behind me. They had been careful to avoid impeding my assault, and yet these bolt shells had come from the far side of the convolute's position, aimed from locations at the opposite end of the main chamber, and thus directly towards us. I crouched down low, running a check to see whether any of my warriors had been struck. Even as I did so, I heard the telltale grind of armor pistons, the whine of servos in motion. I smelled something both foreign and familiar, that curious mix of incense and machine oils, the devotional and the murderous. The convolute's annihilated corpse remnants toppled over. Its fall, and the dissipation of all that steam, smoke, and psionic charge, revealed six warriors striding out into the firelight, bolters drawn and combat blades sizzling. None of them were Imperial fists. Their armor profiles were different, sleeker, larger, seemingly newer, bearing no combat damage. Every move they made was suffused with a greater swagger, a kind of casual, vicious hostility that none of Garrodon's warriors deigned to affect. Their plate was burnished bronze with crimson shoulder guards. I saw one of them half turn as he walked, exposing the chapter badge on his leading shoulder, a bull's head in bloody red, with arching horns like iron pincers. They came to a halt, surrounded by the bodies of the slain. Behind me, I could hear Garrodon squads drawing up close, and knew their own weapons would be trained on the newcomers. Ravathane and the rest of my chamber busied themselves with mopping up the surviving cultists, but that was now a distant and subsidiary task.
Ave, Imperator,
came a harsh voice, spoken from behind a helm pattern I'd never seen before. Of all the chapters of the Imperium we could have hoped to find here, at this time, with matters so febrile, these were perhaps the most unwelcome of all. I found myself almost amused by the madness of it. But they were here. Somehow, given all that had happened, given how straitened the ways of the warp had become, they were here. The Minotaurs. The Minotaurs had come to Terra.
Chapter 12. Alea. After that, I became suspicious of Telam. I became suspicious of the entire Fellowship, having seen what strange roots they had sprung from. Ostensibly, they were the most loyal of the loyal, devoted to the Citadel like no others. Asurma was right. I checked the records of their Psi screening, and nothing was remotely concerning. They laboured diligently. They followed every order given to them, and, in truth, we needed them. Few others would have willingly worked for us, tolerating our foulness as they seemed to. If we had been forced to seek menials from Port Luna, or from even further afield, I suspect we would have struggled. So perhaps I was just looking for an excuse to keep him away from me. Even if I had known nothing of the strange company he claimed descent from, I would have found his fawning and neediness insufferable. He kept trying to find things to help me with, and I kept sending him away. Eventually, I think even he got the message, and the constant combursts started to drop in frequency. I am not sure that keeping myself to myself at that time was very sensible, though. The shadows fell uneasily within the Citadel, crookedly as if broken. I found the echoes of my footfalls somehow out of sync. And when I stopped walking, I could swear that, for a moment, an extra one sounded. Just looking up at the roofs of the cave-like chambers, or trying to figure out the shapes carved into the black stone, made me feel queasy. The euphoria I had felt at coming home proved hard to sustain. This was a home, that was certain, but not one where our history had ever been happy. And not one that gave off any sense of wanting us back here. I told myself this was all paranoia, fueled by the trauma of our near destruction and sudden resurrection. If I saw ghosts around every corner, or came to believe that our servants were liable to poison us in our beds, who could be surprised? We had been hunted for so long that even the absence of an immediate enemy had become unsettling. I closeted myself away from many of my sisters, absorbed in my task. They were busy with their own work, run ragged by constant arrivals of acolytes and the steady stream of communications from the Adeptus Astra Telepathica. Kerapleides, Asurma signed to me on one of the few occasions we were alone together in her chambers. The Master. He wishes to have dominion over us, just as his administration did in the old times. What is it with them all? I signed back. Always they must control. Because they fear. We will resist. There are some advantages being so far out here. That felt like a weak advantage to me. If our only protection was that we were far away from the Council, then that spoke ill of our vaunted prowess as a military force in our own right. I could not imagine a space marine guarding his autonomy through isolation. How fares your investigation? She asked me. I had nothing much to tell her. I could have related my suspicions, I suppose. I could have told her that our foothold on Luna had always been precarious, and that our eventual departure had not been a matter of simple neglect, but as a result of the application of force. I could have told her that elements of the old Imperium, believing they acted in accordance with the Emperor's will, had been behind it. But what would I say after that? Nothing much. And even those few suspicions had no evidence for them, save for the rhymes of a degenerate old woman. It progresses, I signed. That seemed to be enough for her. I began to think that maybe Asoma didn't place too much store by this exercise. Perhaps she hoped that I would get it out of my system, then turn my mind to something more useful, such as training the many acolytes who needed to learn how to use a great blade. Still, I persevered. I felt that some revelations were there, somewhere, waiting to be uncovered. I pored over the few books of lore we had stored in our librarium, almost all of them brought up from Terra. I penetrated as far as I could into the crypts under the inhabited levels, breaking open numerous locked portals, and searching through the dust-caked contents within. On one occasion I was busy in the dark within one such place, rooting through some old supply crates, when I suddenly noticed that Telem was trying to get in touch with me. I wasn't sure why I hadn't picked up his hails before. It looked like he'd been making the attempt for some time. My mood instantly soured, and I considered shutting down the feed altogether. He tried again. The priority bead at my collar pulsed, and I allowed the summary runes to flit across my retinal feed.
Urgent! Please make contact! Urgent!
I opened the link.
Matriarch!
He blurted, sounding panicked. He'd never called me that before. Was he confused? Was he intoxicated?
Please, please, come to meet me. Mainlander Control Tower. I am very worried.
I sent a short affirmative signal. I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong, and yet I also couldn't shake the feeling that Telem was always at the source of it all. I made my way out of the chamber, clambering over upturned crates and hurried up a flight of spiral stairs. As I climbed higher, back into the main body of the citadel, I saw no signs of anything untoward. The lander control complex was not very far away, perched on the southern flank of the main structure, overlooking the pits where the constant stream of orbital lifters came and went. I moved swiftly through the winding corridors. By the time I reached the main operations room, all looked much as it should have done. Banks of augers ran along the far wall, set underneath a range of thick armour-glass screens. These looked out across the landing stages, which were set at the base of the main trunk of the citadel. Out across those artificial plains, one of the reception pits was opening slowly, its heavy adamantine doors sliding apart to reveal docking cages below, glowing a deep red from the guidance lumen banks. Three operatives were on duty in the chamber, all of them fellowship menials. As they worked at their stations, runes shuffled softly across their viewscreens. None of them, to my eyes, raising any cause for concern. But they were not the only occupants. One of my sisters, in full armour, had Telem pinned to the rear wall. He looked bruised and sweaty. She was in the process of snapping wrist restraints on him.
Matriarch! He cried out as I entered. Listen! Listen, please!
I didn't know the sister. I felt somewhat embarrassed to even be there. Telem looked as if he had finally gone as mad as the woman in the wasteland. What's going on? I signed to my sister. This one attempted to prevent a scheduled supply landing, came the reply. You should watch your menial more closely, sister. He almost succeeded. Telem's eyes were wild. His jerkin was half twisted around his neck.
It is coming down now! He blurted. Prevent it!
My sense of embarrassment intensified. I made a sign of apology to the sister, then requested that she take him into confinement.
They have come again, just as they did before.
Those had been the witch's words. I looked again at Telem and saw that his disarrangement was mostly fear. He was scrabbling to get free of his bonds, to break out of the sister's grip, to get back to the consoles. I glanced back over at the viewports. The sky outside them was black and empty. How long before the lander gets here? I signed. One of the operatives had swiveled round to face me. It has already departed the relay station, Lord, she said. The process cannot be halted. The doors are opening. Telam's face went white. Let him go, I signed to my sister. She stared at me for a moment, so I underlined it with an imperative adjuster. Telam broke from her grasp, breathing heavily, his hands still locked behind his back. Tell me what you fear, I signed, swiftly.
I worked up there, he said, speaking quickly, falling over his words. Long time ago, still have contacts on the clearance teams. Something's wrong. Lander isn't what it looks like. Do not let it come down.
The procedure is fully in order, said the operative calmly, reaching for a lens and showing me the clearance codes. The lander was full, another consignment of novices for training. We have already checked with the relay station.
That wasn't them!
Telam shouted, trying to fight his way back to the consoles. I grabbed him and held him back.
Close the doors! He screamed. Destroy it, if you need to!
The operative looked up at me warily. I cannot do that. It is at descent velocity. Close the doors now and it will impact on the surface. By then, I could even see it. A faint white spot of light growing in the night sky. In a few moments, that dot would resolve into the rectangular profile of the lander, dropping fast, its path set by its machine spirits, and now unalterable. The same routine was played out dozens of times a cycle, never changing. It had never needed to. Telam struggled against my grip.
Close the doors, he pleaded with me. There are no acolytes on that lander.
All eyes turned to me. Only seconds remained. For some reason, I saw the old woman's face again, grinning at me, daring me to act. They will come again now, just as they did before. Close the doors, I signed. The operatives stared back disbelievingly. The other sister took a step towards me, her right hand dropping to the hilt of her blade. Do it, I ordered, infusing the gesture with every power of command I could muster. Notify Sister Commander Asoma. Clear the outer chambers. What happened next is fragmented in my recollection. The sister attempted to stop me. I do not blame her for that. I would have done the same thing in her position, given the information she had before her. She managed to get her blade half-drawn, and I went for her, shoving her back into the wall and chopping at her neck with my gauntlet. I was half aware that Telam had rushed back over to the console, despite his hands being tied. I remember him crashing into one of the operatives, going for the control levers. Why did I act that way just then, with such complete certainty? It feels irrational now, in hindsight. I was even semi-aware of its strangeness at the time, like some figure of legend condemned by a curse, but unable to extract herself from it. I knew that Telam was right. There were no living things on that lander. It could not be allowed to pass within the armoured exterior of the citadel. The antipathy I had felt towards him for so long was not because he was an enemy, but because he was a reminder of something I had wished to forget, that we were always the hunted ones. I held back from seriously hurting the other sister. Even in my desperation, I did not wish her any harm, nor the menials, nor Telam. I only acted out of a terrible fear, knowing that seconds were elapsing and the lander was hurtling now, caught by Luna's gravity and plunging towards its prescribed subterranean berth. Somehow, I do not know exactly how he did it, Telam managed to activate the door-close mechanism. As I grappled with the sister and he brawled with the three other menials present, the blast shields out on the plain began to slide back towards one another, even as the lander emerged into full visual range, dropping fast, its retros firing, its course set. There had not been time to send a warning. We were still struggling with one another as the lander shot down past the windows, a blur of grey just for a split moment, before the screens went black again. Then everything exploded. The ground beneath our feet rocked, pitching, cracking open. The panes shattered, blown inwards by the shock wave from outside. The air turned to fire, howling up and around us. My armor protected me from the worst of it, though I wore no helm, and the extreme heat seared across my exposed flesh. I threw myself into a tight crouch, scrabbling for the helm at my belt, pulling it up and managing to twist it in place. I staggered back to my feet, as did the other sister, but by then there was nothing to be done for Telam and the others, who had taken the brunt of the explosion's force. They lay burned and broken across the chamber floor, covered in slivers of armor glass. I heard alarms going off. I detected movement close by, guards running, security portals slamming closed, reserve power coils shunting into gear. The landing stages had turned black, not from the ever-present lunar night, but from a single, truly immense column of smoke, flecked with burning fragments from the lander's outer hull. Flames still licked at the cracked frames of the empty view screens. The other sister stared at me, looking stunned. In that moment, despite the shock, both of us immediately understood three things. First, that the lander could not possibly have been carrying human cargo. The explosion had been so huge that it must have been packed with explosives. Second, that the citadel still stood. Third, that if the lander had made it past the outer shielding and down into the docking cages, those explosives would have gone off deep within the tower's foundations, detonating in such a confined space that it might plausibly have brought down the entire structure. For a moment, I found myself frozen by that knowledge, unable to make a decision. I was only shaken out of it by the other sister gesturing towards me in urgent thought mark.
"The Sister Commander," she signed. "Contact the Sister Commander."
Certainty returned. I stared out across the burning landing stages. Even through the roar of the flames, I could hear agonized cries from those who had been working down there. My anger returned, as hot and acrid as it had ever been.
"Do it yourself," I signed, pushing clear from the battered walls and activating the chamber's external locks. Then I was running again, just as I had always done, just as I had been doing non-stop ever since Eraser. Now fueled not by fear, but by fury. What I did next was no doubt reckless. For all I knew, the orbital relay station had been destroyed or was in the hands of an enemy. I should have gone back to Asurma, just as I had been told to. No doubt there were casualties in the citadel and work was required to secure it. Perhaps other attacks had been launched, and all hands were needed to mount a defense. None of that crossed my mind. Despite my anger, I did not act entirely without reason in those moments. This had been a clandestine attack, one that had been designed with at least the veneer of a plausible deniability, staged to look like an accident. Whoever had done it had therefore not been able, or perhaps not willing, to assault us openly, or with overwhelming force. That meant that the relay station probably still existed, and that there might be some trace of the attackers up there. Getting into orbit, though, would be a challenge. I had no idea whether any of our lifters remained in operation. The entire landing site would certainly be in lockdown, even if we still retained the ability to use some of the regular carrier vehicles. Thankfully, my extensive travels up and down the entire breadth of the Citadel had given me an almost unrivaled knowledge of its darker secrets. I had discovered chambers that no one else knew of, networks of corridors that had not been occupied, I assumed, since the Crusade Age. Most of those places were empty or crammed with junk, but one set of tunnels led directly from the catacombs under the bedrock of the Citadel's roots and up again into the service bays for the maintenance shuttles. I ran through those hidden ways now, keeping my head low, going as fast and as surely as my body would allow. It was the first time I had stretched myself for a long time, and I was pleased to feel my muscles respond. I did not have my great blade. There had not been time to retrieve it, and so was armed with a las pistol and combat knife. That reduced my killing power, but freed me up to be swifter. I tore through the narrow passages, swerving around the plentiful debris, before reaching the sealed portal leading upward. I hauled the bolts back, entered the access codes I had determined when I was last here, then kicked the hatch open. I emerged into a world of filth and ashes. The maintenance shuttle's launch silos were set far from the main docking cages, but even so, the underground spaces were still choked with smog. I wondered if the outer docking doors had not closed completely, allowing destruction to penetrate underground, or perhaps the impact shock had destroyed some other system, flooding the whole foundation level with burning fuel. I had no time to investigate further, but raced up a crawlway towards the nearest shuttle. As I reached the rows of suspended vehicles, each one clasped tight within an adamantine launch cage, I was relieved to see that they were intact, and that the machinery around them appeared to be undamaged. I clambered up an access ramp and hit the hatch release. It jerked open, exposing a cramped interior. I wormed my way up into the cockpit and slid myself into the pilot's seat. The ship was a tiny one-person craft with just enough power and fuel capacity for a single journey up to the relay station. It had been designed for running repairs and salvage operations and had no weaponry save a pair of grabber claws under the fuselage. I worked rapidly, activating the dormant machine spirit and beginning the launch cycle. Red lumens flickered across the console, indicating that at least some functions had been damaged, but the docking claw squealed and boomed into action, lifting me up and tilting the shuttle's nose skyward. As I locked the restraint harness in and pulled the straps tight, I saw the chamber's outer iris doors open, causing more smoke to flood down into the launch bay. I activated the thrusters and felt the kick of the plasma drives roaring into life. The docking cage split apart and the shuttle boomed out of the gates. I boosted clear of the outer doors and punched through the rolling clouds of smoke above. I set a direct course for the relay station, entering some of the vectors manually since the Citadel's guidance grid seemed to be malfunctioning. My comm feed swelled with incoming hails, but I ignored them all. Only once I was up to full speed and angled correctly did I risk a glance out of the real viewers to see what I was leaving behind. It was a picture of destruction. The Citadel was masked in huge pillars of thick black smoke. Flames had kindled across its outer surface. The landing plane itself was almost entirely hidden from view, its series of circular apertures wreathed with smog. I caught a glimpse of where the sabotaged lander had come down. The site was still on fire, and it looked like a lake of burning promethium had spread beyond the perimeter. I could see little enough of the lander itself, and guessed that it had been entirely obliterated. I turned back, concentrating now on getting the shuttle to where it needed to be. The lunar surface dropped behind me, its horizon swiftly curving, until I saw the relay station dead ahead, glittering coldly against the starscape beyond. It appeared to be unharmed from the outside, just as it had been when I last passed through it. I did not attempt to raise its crew through the standard hails, but merely fixed a location for docking. Using the shuttle made this easier. There were a number of service airlocks it could access that larger craft could not. As I burned into close range, maintaining high speed until the last possible moment, I saw the rows of landers hanging from their docking clamps, all in the Citadel's own black livery, not one of them looking out of the ordinary. No bigger void ships were berthed, which was something. Nothing still there had the capacity for ranged transit, so if any of those who had done this were still aboard, there was a limit to how far away they could get. I slammed into the nearest airlock and reached for my pistol as the oxygen hissed through the interface tubes. The wait must have been just a few seconds, but it felt like minutes. Eventually, the cockpit lumens switched to green, and I pushed myself out of the pilot's seat and wriggled back down to the egress hatch. As I disembarked, I heard the blare of klaxons going off, voices shouting orders. I raced towards the control chamber. As I ran, I passed menials going the other way, most carrying sidearms, none of whom attempted to hinder me. When I reached my destination, I found what I had feared. It was not a large room. The traffic between the Citadel and elsewhere was predictable in nature and in relatively low volume, so the control consoles were only manned by a few operatives and a lone data servitor. All of them were now dead. lying on the floor with pinpoint wounds to the back of their heads. A dozen of the station's security detail stood guard over the bodies while technicians pored through the landing records. "How did this happen?" I signed to the head of security. The man's face was grey.
"It was a standard cargo transfer,"
he said.
"Bulk foodstuffs, supplies, just one of many. Somehow they got..."
"Where are they now?"
"The cargo came in on the void ship Ergana, departed again for Port Luna 3 hours ago."
That was before the attack. So they had to have left someone behind to infiltrate the control chamber and communicate with the receiving crew at ground level. How had they got out? Were they still on the station?
"No one leaves,"
I signed, and reached over to grab a data slate showing a schema of the station layout. I had precious little time. The crew here had done what they could in the aftermath. I could see that the docking ports had all been locked, but the enemy, whoever it was, must have had some kind of plan for this eventuality. My eyes flickered over the diagrams. All I had now was instinct, the sense of where I would go. Were I the one being hunted? I was not good at this kind of mental projection. I might well have predicted where one of my soulless sisters would have gone or what they would have done, but the ways of the true human were always hard for me to unpick. The response teams were already rushing towards the docked landers, aiming to secure them all before any attempt was made to break free. The same went for the batteries of emergency escape pods. That was sensible and predictable. To evade capture, even for a short time, an enemy would have to find somewhere less obvious to hole up. The options were limited, since the control chamber did not link directly to many other locations, and their time to make a decision must have been short. My eyes were drawn to a small node in the network of rooms and corridors, an insignificant place set amid a cluster of further insignificant places. The ident runes on the schema indicated that it was a refrigerated storage unit, one used to keep overflow supplies intact in the event of a hold-up during onward processing. The cover story for the infiltrators had been as cargo transfer menials. For as long as that story held, access to that location would have been easy. I turned and ran, pushing past anyone in my way. I vaulted down an access stairway, leaping to the ground at its base and then sprinting along a poorly lit corridor. Soon I was in the dirtier, less looked after parts of the station, where only servitors might limp from time to time. I had memorized the layout and went surely through the branching routes, keeping my weapon drawn the whole time. I turned the final corner and saw a locked slide door ahead of me. A single shot was enough to blow the seal, and I burst into the chamber beyond. The woman at the far end of the room spun round, eyes wide. I could see that she had been busy. A refrigeration capsule was open in front of her, steaming with condensate. It was big enough to take her inside, and she had already stripped off her crew uniform and placed vital sign regulators on her chest and neck. She was of the Fellowship. By now I recognized the signs, the skin pallor, the low body weight, the way she looked at me. Even in her fear and shock, she still saw a matriarch in front of her.
"Remain where you are,"
I ordered, bringing my pistol to bear and training the las bead onto her forehead. That was my great mistake. She did not fear dying. That had always been the most likely outcome for her. I should have run straight for her, immobilized her before she could react. Instead, she merely smiled.
"As you command," she said, and bit down hard.
A cloud of poison gas immediately engulfed her. She crumpled, her body sliding halfway into the open capsule, her outstretched hand lolling weakly. Cursing, I stowed my pistol and rushed towards her. My helm gave me all the protection I needed from the toxins, so I pulled her mouth open, trying to extract whatever it was that she had ingested. I was too late. I could feel that she was dead even as I took her in my arms. I looked down at her face and saw a kind of beatific satisfaction written onto it. She had done what she had been trained for. Failing to make it out alive was nothing compared to that. She had succeeded. She had won. I curled my gauntlet into a fist and crunched it once, twice into that satisfied face. I wanted to keep going, but slowly, grudgingly, I forced myself to stop. I was breathing heavily. I smelled the blood I had spilt, and it felt like an insult. I remembered what I had promised to Soma the first time we had conversed. Never again. But it was not over yet. Some trace would have been left behind. Something I could hunt down. One way or another, I promised myself. Vengeance would be served.
Chapter 13. Jack. So, of course, despite everything I had told myself I would not do, I went to see him. I'd been putting it off through pride. At every stage, I had told myself that I had emerged from behind his cloak now and could hardly run back for guidance whenever things became difficult. Whenever I reached the stage where a word of advice might have been useful, just to take advantage of his boundless experience, I had deferred it, telling myself that if I started down that road now, then I would never learn to stand on my own two feet. What, in all honesty, had I been scared of? I had no doubts within myself that I was capable of doing the job. Any suggestion that I was somehow still his subordinate came from elsewhere. The little jibes, the subtle insinuations from both allies and enemies. And so I came to see my stubbornness as a kind of weakness. I was trying to prove myself to those who didn't matter, and in doing so, was depriving myself of help from the one man on Terra who, I could be wholly sure, would always be on my side. I kept the journey secret, at least within reasonable bounds. I took no one with me and travelled in an unmarked flyer. Tiron's apartments were deep within the inner palace, and doing so was reasonably safe. It didn't take me long. As I walked through his thickly carpeted antechambers, observing the clutter of artifacts, vases, and paintings, I felt a curious mix of emotions. It was good to see his things again. The place smelled of him, those expensive odours he wore, each one worth, so I had always liked to imagine, a month's tithe from a minor world. It took me back to when I was his aide and he was my master. Now I was the master and he was... I do not know. There were few precedents for retirement in our careers. Only in death, and all that, except that Gilliman had already changed that script. Tiron was still alive and, as far as I knew, still thriving. I went into his private room, the one he had always used for audiences. It was as plush as ever, dotted with cabinets and sideboards, all of them filled with beautiful things. I wondered where he got the coin from to maintain it all. Perhaps his imperial pension was sufficient, assuming it was being paid in these troubled times. More likely, he was still up to his old tricks, calling in favours or managing lines of credit from his wide circle of friends. When he entered to greet me, I saw that he had indeed aged. It had been less than a year since I had seen him last, and yet it looked as if 20 had passed. Evidently he had been right to refuse Gilliman's offer to take him on Indomitus as a remembrancer. He would never have withstood the rigours of extended void passage. Still, his face had that same old wrinkled, agreeable shrewdness. He might have lost a bit of weight, but he still filled out his fine robes well enough, and walked with the assistance of a single ivory cane. He came over to me, holding out a ring-crusted hand. When I took it, I felt the slight tremor in his fingers.
"Dear Anamasa," he said.
He'd never used my given name in the past, and it felt odd to hear it from him now.
"It has been too long."
"You look well," I lied.
"You look tired. How are you finding it?"
We sat down in plush armchairs. A chime sounded, and soon enough, drinks and sweetmeats were brought in by one of his young helpers.
"Much as I expected," I said truthfully.
"They will not come together. They will not cooperate. Each thinks they are master of the others, and so nothing is done while the planet runs to ruin. Tiron laughed. And so you are organizing them, he said, nudging them in the right direction, just as we always did before. I took a piece of candied sucrose. It had been sculpted into the form of a flower. Nudging is easier when the council is stable, I said, popping it into my mouth. Thrown, it was superb. But this one is in flux. They do not know one another yet, so will not commit to anything. If there were a single threat, one obvious war to fight, I think they would act well enough. Instead, there are hundreds of threats, and so they do not.
Yes, it has not been straightforward with all that has been going on.
He looked sympathetic. He was wise enough not to patronize me by suggesting solutions, though I could tell he was itching to offer them. He had spent his whole career being approached for counsel, and now fewer souls sought him out. I imagine the adjustment had not been easy.
Tell me, though. Indulge an old man. What have you done?
I told him of our attempts to mobilize naval forces to restore security. I told him of my meetings with Ashariel and Perith, and the formulation of the Quiet Road.
Good, good,
he said, seemingly delighted.
Provoke one by provoking the other. Perith was always an effective operator. She'll have kept ships back for just such an eventuality. And it needs to happen. Shameful, what is taking place out there. Shameful.
It was harder to broach the true reason I had come. I spoke to Roscavla, too, I said.
Oh? How is she? I know very little. I hear she has a temper.
You might say that. She is refusing to call the council to full conclave. That prevents much being achieved.
Interesting. Why?
She believes a member wishes to subvert the reforms.
Of course.
She believes someone is preventing effective suppression of the disturbances to discredit the new regime.
Very likely.
And so I need to find out who is behind it.
Yes, I suppose you do.
He seemed to be extremely relaxed about it all. I am not sure how much credence to place on the accusations, I said. I'm not sure she is correct. Tiron pursed his lips and took a sip of his honey-coloured wine.
The judgment is a fine one. Are there High Lords aiming to frustrate the will of the Regent? Undoubtedly. Gilliman would have expected no less, but he couldn't have replaced them all. Are there any who would go so far as to protect known heretics and traitors? That I do not know. It would be a risky strategy. If a word of it got out, then the full force of the Inquisition would turn on them. I am not sure even a High Lord could withstand that for long.
He took one of the flower sweets.
Difficult.
I wondered if he was being deliberately unhelpful. More likely, I realized, was that he was waiting for the explicit question. He didn't want to assume that I was asking for help, when it may have been that I merely wished to update him on the situation. That was solicitous of him. If there were a High Lord working to further the violence, I ventured. The list is long. Ashariel, Drachmar, Raskian, and Phaedix are all known static sympathizers. Any one of them, or combination of them, could be working to frustrate us.
Ashariel is new in position,
Tiron countered.
If it were him, he could not be doing it alone.
Agreed. But the others are established and powerful. Of those who still serve, I do not see many other candidates. Tiron frowned.
Arx, perhaps. We do not know what place the Inquisition has in Gilliman's plans.
Perhaps. Though there are more likely candidates for revolt. The old masters, the ones who were deposed. Hematalion, Slist,
glamour, even dander.
You Metallion never accepted the Primarch, that's true.
Tyrion looked thoughtful.
He even tried to persuade me to come alongside him in that, before Vorlys. But then, they all felt like that then. Arx did. Slist certainly did. I cannot imagine Drachmar feeling differently, and she remains in office too.
He took another sweetmeat.
They are losing everything, see. They resisted, and that was natural. They may continue to resist, or wish to, though access to resources would be the problem. They remain wealthy and connected, but that only goes so far. Their replacements wield the true power, the Arbutes and the military. So if they were involved, it would have to be in conjunction with a serving member. Your problem remains unresolved, and you are still looking at those sitting around the table, at least in part.
I took my first sip of the wine. Of course, it was excellent. Worth coming here for alone, at least if I had shared Tyrion's appetite for luxury. I can scarcely believe we're discussing such things, I said. Tyrion chuckled.
I can.
Then he looked thoughtful.
I have often defended them. They were always despised. They were said to be uncaring and distant. They were the latter, to be sure, but rarely the former. To some degree or other, they wished for power as a means to an end. They wished to see the Imperium well ordered, to have it survive for another generation. That end required cruelty and self-belief. But it was a noble calling.
He smiled to himself, though it was not a humorous smile.
I remember, though, when the days of blindness came. One thing in particular. We had requests for help from every direction, and we could do nothing. We had made our decision. We would survive and let them die, so that there would be something preserved to build on if the time ever came. It was the right decision, I still believe, but I had to speak to the governors and the prefects while they railed at me. There was one, a woman, somewhere out east. She was weeping at me as I tried to give my excuses. They were tears of rage by the end, for our decision no doubt ended her life and that of everyone who worked for her. I told her to remain stalwart. Oh, can you believe that? Remain stalwart. She told me I had murdered her.
He looked down at the glass in his hand.
A single soul. My decisions over the years must have ended 1,000 lives. But hers, I remember. And after that, I found I could no longer defend the High Lords with quite the same vigor as before. My mind still believed it, but my heart hesitated. So even if Gilliman had not come, I could not have carried on serving them. It passes to you now to negotiate those things. Are they monsters? Are there things they would not do? Can they be traitors? I don't know. I hope not, but I don't know.
He had never spoken like that with me, not even during that brief time when we had been thrown together. Maybe it was age, weakening him and making him maudlin. I will be honest. I had not come here for such talk. I had come for something harder, a suggestion, a thread I could follow. Tyrion knew the Council better than any man alive, and I had reached the stage where I needed something to latch onto. I cared very little whether the High Lords were worthy of service. I did not ask myself such questions. I did, however, care to discover whether one or more of them was conspiring against the mandates of their office.
I have to start somewhere,
I said, hopefully gently. He looked up, as if roused from a dream.
Of course you do,
he said, pulling himself upright in his chair.
Of course you do.
I waited patiently. I felt more strongly than ever then that it had been a mistake to come, and that I should have continued to trust my own judgment. Some seams had been mined out, much as I might wish otherwise.
Of all of them,
he said, speaking slowly as he thought the matter through.
Of all the ones I knew well, only one would not have hesitated to do what you are suggesting. If you go back through history, examining every event where the council was riven by treachery, you will find the same name over and again. The Grand Master of Assassins. Vangorich was only the most infamous. There have been others. Which brings us to Phaedix.
He looked up at me.
Does he have a motive? I do not know. The regent has not yet attempted to move on the temples, but he may yet do so. And Phaedix is a known static veteran, wedded to the old protocols. I am unsure what judgment I still have in me. I no longer keep up with the gossip like I once did. I have no evidence. Much of this may be coloured by dislike, for the man scared me deeply when I had to deal with him.
I met his gaze. His old eyes were not as penetrating as they had once been, and wandered a little. But there was something there still, some kernel of an old acumen.
But you came here for a name,
Tyrion said, lifting the glass to his lips again.
For what it's worth, take that one.
Of all the names he could have given me, that one was perhaps the most unwelcome. Phaedix's reputation went before him and was well deserved. He was a killer, both by inclination and by duty. His entire life was devoted to it. He controlled networks of thousands of operatives, all buried deep within imperial structures, all reporting to him alone. At the knotted center of that web were the imperial assassins themselves, the ultimate hunters, dispatched to deal with our greatest threats. Tyrion was right to be scared of him. We all were. I remembered well enough when we had engaged with him before, during the debate over dissolution. I remembered receiving the blood-stained casket back, the sign that our agent within his networks had been detected and eliminated. We had not been able to insert a replacement since then, and so our knowledge of his activities was limited. I voxed Mordecai on the way back from Tyrion's chambers, telling him to meet me in our Chamber of Records. At that stage, I did not know exactly how best to proceed, and used the journey over to think through the options. When I arrived, I found him waiting for me as ordered. I locked the door behind me, activated the sensor bafflers, and took a seat. The chamber was dark, lit only by thin banks of sulfur lumens. We were surrounded by large cogitator housings, all of them clicking and whirring as data moved around our system. He had already started work and had retrieved some parchment files that might be of use, mostly reports of dubious value from our operatives working far from their intended subject's gaze.
Phaedix,
he said morosely.
Could it be worse?
It could always be worse, I replied, starting to leaf through the documents on the tabletop before me. These are the facts. He is a dangerous man. He is a High Lord, one of those with experience and full command of his kingdom. Perhaps Gilliman chose to leave him in place because of his value. We must consider the alternative, too, that he did not feel strong enough to remove him yet. It was a hard thing to entertain, a Primarch being wary of such a character, but not entirely beyond imagination. As Tyrion had said, Gilliman could hardly have dismissed every individual who might possibly have had an issue with the reforms, and he would have needed Phaedix's support to launch Indomitus. The Officio Assassinorum had been mobilized for that exercise, just as every other conceivable institution had been. The Eversaurs in particular, they said, had been shipped out in huge numbers to sow terror ahead of the advance of the conventional troops.
What would his motivation be?
Mordecai asked. The same as any other, I replied. He does not share the vision of change. He has become used to operating a certain way, having certain privileges. Everything is upended now. The Adeptus Astartes and the Assassins never rubbed along well. Perhaps Phaedix objects to a space marine giving the orders. Mordecai looked unconvinced.
Weak pickings,
he grumbled. It's all we have, I said, a little snappily, reaching for another dossier. And we have to start somewhere. The question is, how? I will not risk sending more of our people into his citadel, not as things stand. We must think of another way. I ran my hands through my hair, feeling the effect of too much work and too little rest. What else do we know? He does not act directly. He requires intermediaries, his agents. If he were moving against the Reform Council, would there be enough of them still here? Many must have been requisitioned by the Crusade or stationed out in remote temples, so he'd have to bring some of them back, surely. Mordecai turned to the cogitators, pulling up more records onto the lenses. Glowing phosphor runes scrolled under the crystal.
A lawful deployment of an imperial assassin requires a two-thirds vote of assent from the council,
he said, sliding down through various in-camera documents.
In regular times. But the regent will not be hamstrung by that requirement now, and so neither will their master.
True, I said, watching the various facsimile copies of warrants flicker on the screens. But Gilliman is a stickler for the Lex. He will still be issuing his own legal documents, giving something for the Ordo Sicarius to keep an eye on. We have access to those. Mordecai nodded, working to retrieve the data. Although the information could be slow to reach us, we knew a fair amount concerning the progress of Indomitus. Regular astropathic bulletins reached the Senatorum bureaucracy, detailing the steady accumulation of fleet assets and indicating the results of the first engagements. Almost all of this material was highly classified, but my office was one of those cleared to receive all but the most confidential of bulletins. Figures began to emerge, totals, estimates, projections. Just as expected, Gilliman was signing warrants of assassination, and meticulously recording them within the Crusade annals. The bulk of those warrants were as one would expect, and many had been issued long before he had left Terra. Vindicare clades, in particular, had been sent ahead of naval vanguards, sometimes by a matter of months, where they would wait in the shadows until the order to execute came.
So we have these,
Mordecai murmured, pulling up more.
I cannot see yet how it helps us.
We are looking for discrepancies, I said, poring over the runes with him. Anything there that shouldn't be.
Or not there that should.
Quite. After a while, it became numbing, looking at all those fleet reference numbers and warrant idents. As far as I could see, it was all in order, all as it should be. Most of the location details and date stamps were vague and redacted, which was also to be expected. We were seeing broad indications of activity, not the detail. I pushed my chair back, placed my forehead in my hands, and tried to think. Phaedix wouldn't have left a data trail, I muttered, beginning to feel the exercise was already futile. That's his function, to move in secret even from us. All we are seeing is material he's happy for us to see. Mordecai said nothing. He kept working, pulling more reports from the system. Suddenly, it came to me. Can you derive a total from all of this? I asked. The exact sum of all recorded deployments within Indomitus.
Give me a few moments.
I got to work myself. I pulled out of the data silo used for the off-world strategic data and delved instead into our domestic records. I had complete documentation for the many camera superior sessions.